It's The Wonky Show, and this week, as the all-important January the 15th UCAS deadline for applications arrives, it's a recruitment special.
So that means that applicants might not dare to apply to University X in September, but they might well have been able to get into University X the following August. So, you know, there's complicating factors here around the reputation of universities, around published tariffs. But, you know, when I'm looking at challenges around regional participation rates, I do think it's a big issue.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, recording from the Wonky HQ in London. This week, in a break to our usual format, it's a recruitment special in association with SMRS. And we have three amazing guests. In Cheltenham, we have Claire Marchant, Chief Executive of UCAS. Claire, your highlight of the week, please.
Probably on Monday, actually, we announced a partnership with Which. So we've got the Which Uni content on UCAS.com now. So 30 million students able to see that. And that was a real breakthrough for us. I thought that was a great piece of content, city guides, etc., all there for students to see. So that made me very happy.
In York, we have Dan Bainan, Head of Education at SMRS. Dan, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, it's actually big in York, I think, on a sunny day in a beautiful city staring at the Minster. I'm up here for the Case Marketing Institute. So there's 40 marketing professionals in HE spending 3 days learning and collaborating with senior colleagues. So it's an example of the collaboration that's still possible in higher education, despite all the competitive challenge we're about to discuss.
And in Birkdale, we have Alison Cohen, Director of Marketing at the University of Liverpool. Alison, your hire to the week, please.
Okay, mine, I think, is both personal and professional this week. It's Children's Mental Health Week, and I stumbled across my kids talking about some of the activities that we're doing at school, which is both exciting, I think, that they're talking about it, but also from a university perspective, my children are 8 years old, are being taught about this stuff at such a young age, and it gives me a bit of hope for the future.
Great, thanks all. Let's dive right in. UCAS has published data this week for the current application cycle. That's to the 15th of January deadline. Claire, can you just talk us through the headlines?
Sure. And obviously, we're publishing this about 15 days after the January 15th deadline passed, so it takes a huge amount of work to pull it all together. But hopefully, what we've given is a really sort of short, sharp, easy to access account of 15th of January. We've got a 1.2% increase in the number of applications, which I think is really healthy. There's loads of good news in here. You know, I think the application rate, particularly. Of 39.5% is really healthy. There's some really interesting trends in there. So I would point to regional differences, and you'll see London, their application rate going over 50%. And that compares quite starkly to some places in the north of England, but also in the southwest. So I think there's some interesting things that require more analysis and thought. Certainly a big story you will have seen is what's happening outside of the EU. So in our non-EU countries applying into UKHE, and a real testament, I suppose, to how world-class UKHE is still seen. So particularly those Chinese and Indian applicants coming through, almost a third increase in both of those countries. I think there are some things in there, so it's lots of good news. I think there's some things in there that give us further food for thought, and certainly we at UCAS will be looking at more. So mature students we've highlighted, but a lot of the increase there is because of the nursing increases. And so actually, if you take out the nursing increases, then what is happening with mature students' appetite and demand for coming into higher education? And again, you know, good news in terms of wedding participation, but actually if you get below that decreasing the ratio between most advantaged and most disadvantaged, are there regional differences? Are there differences in terms of tariff sort of type of provider that students are going to from most disadvantaged areas? And I think finally for me, it's certainly at UCAS, and this is a sort of personal but a UCAS perspective, is what are those routes? What are we giving for particularly UK 18-year-olds as alternatives to traditional higher education, and getting some parity of those alternative routes and making those simple and straightforward to apply for? So things like degree and higher apprenticeships is something that will be a big focus for us in the year ahead. And January 15th just gives that even more momentum. So that would be my sort of canter through it. We have tried to keep it short and sharp, so it's easy for people to access, but then I provide all these data dashboards that people can, you know, if they're really interested, they can go in and manipulate the data and find out what they're particularly interested in.
Thanks. And as you mentioned, Claire, there's some good news, but definitely some challenges. And some things jumped out at me looking at the data over the last 24 hours. One of them was the gap between women and men and the growth of those different cohorts. Women are now 1.4 times more likely to apply than men by the January deadline. What's going on there?
I mean, it's a well-established sort of trend now. I think my concern is we get below the sort of macro-level trend and we understand what's going on for women and men, even at a subject level. So if you go below that, and we did do a publication the summer of last year, which showed that actually you've still got quite traditional choices for women and men within higher education. So women still going very high in terms of education and social work and things like that, and men still outnumbering women in things like engineering, computing. And we have to get below those, because they have very obvious feeds into graduate employability and the sort of salary levels that you might see post-graduation. And then you couple that sort of data with where we are on gender pay gap and things like that. I think it's important to get below what is, you know, and I am concerned about that gap, but I think it's important also to see what those individual groups, those two groups are studying. And that isn't changing. We aren't shifting it. We aren't getting more women into STEM. You know, we are in pockets of the country, but not overall. And so that would be where some of the focus has to start. And, you know, I come from a local authority background. You know, if you don't start this early years and primary, key stage two, you don't make the impact by the time they get to 17, 18 year old in terms of the choices that they make.
Dan, is there anything that jumped out at you from the data this week?
I mean, we've seen quite a variance in application performance in terms of regional differentiations and reflected in the data. Even within local institutional competitor sets, we've seen some quite big variances. I'm interested in the opportunity outside London to increase the application rate. You know, we've spent a lot of time delivering on trying to raise aspiration. I just wonder whether in parts of the country there's an issue with what happens after we've raised that aspiration in terms of the follow-up support, encouraging people to take the step to apply. Do we need to do more to encourage participation in particular areas? It feels like the problem is not that in London. The problem for institutions would be more around converting those, you know, that massive group of applicants in that place. I was thinking about WP, you know, and even though there's some, it feels like it's trying to be a good news story, it still feels like it isn't in terms of those most advantaged being, you know, is it more than twice as likely to go into higher education? So although progress, but I'm not quite there ready to see it as particularly positive. So much more needs to be done there, I think. So the other thing I noticed was January starts for international students going through the roof in terms of applications in all parts of the UK, you know, from the South Coast to the Midlands to the North, you know, being, you know, really growing hugely. And obviously the visa situation will help with that. So they were a few of the things that we've noticed as an organisation.
And Alison, from your perspective in a university, is does things look on track for this cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as others have said, you know, some of the numbers are really, really positive. I think the gap, although it's not narrowed too much, but I think a narrowing of the gap in terms of advantage and disadvantage students is really positive, and particularly for a university of like Liverpool, where we pay a lot of attention to that. The London figures, I think, are very interesting. And I just wonder, and I'm not saying this with any degree of confidence, but whether there is any correlation between, you know, where parents are located, and obviously there's more investment in schools in London, but where people who have been to university are choosing to live, and whether there's a knock-on effect in the north of England, perhaps not as many graduates are living in some of these areas. What I'd, you know, do hope is that some of the initiatives that have been put in place in areas like London might follow through in the northeast, particularly. The third of students wanting to find out about apprenticeships, I thought was really interesting, and I think that's just one for universities to keep a watching brief on in terms of how that plays out and what sort of information they're looking for, but also the types of opportunities.
Do you think apprenticeships, the interest in apprenticeships is going to translate into real demand in the market over the next few years?
Certainly I do. I think it's a demand and supply thing there. I think, you know, our survey work, and we are sitting in National Apprenticeship Week, so I've done a lot of social media activity this week and getting a lot of interaction from students around that. So I think there is a demand there. I think there's a supply issue in terms of understanding how to access that supply. So certainly when I talk to students, and I probably talk to tens of students each week, they find it difficult to navigate. They don't know where to go. It might be very, very different per region. It might be different for SMEs versus very large employers, some of which have made massive headroads into degree apprenticeships, higher apprenticeships. And so I think there's just something about, particularly for us at UCAS, but other organisations, to help navigate those students through that. But there's also then making it easier for employers. And I do, you know, a lot of work with two of the local enterprise partnerships, where I hear again and again that businesses find it difficult to navigate when they're seeking to supply those apprenticeships. So I think the demand is there. I think there's a huge amount of demand, a huge amount of interest. It's whether we can translate that over the coming years. And that will be a question both for government policy, but also for how easy we make it for businesses and how easy we make it for students.
Yeah, and perhaps universities could play more of a role in terms of helping those employers to actually engage with and recruit those apprentices. I think sometimes that model is slightly odd in the delivery, comes from the institutions, and the recruitment comes from the employers. And maybe that there's expertise in the universities that could contribute to that a bit more effectively, I think, if we're going to, you know, raise that number significantly.
I think I'd add to that from a student perspective. I think there will be more demand over time. I think potentially it's a little confusing for students at the outset, because the go-to university narrative is so ingrained, and there's so much work that happens in that space. So for them to truly understand what apprenticeships offer, and also, as Claire said, you know, how they navigate the information and they find the right information for them. But certainly, you know, I think it's very welcome that there's an increased focus on this for students, and they will be a more desirable route for students to get into the careers of their choice.
I was just wondering about the modelling of EU student numbers. Some people are, you know, modelling for really, really, really significant falls in those. I wonder whether we might still see certain numbers coming from different EU countries that don't perhaps need the funding support as much as others. I don't know whether anyone's, you know, got a particular approach or experience on that they might want to share.
Certainly, I wouldn't read too much into the 860 fall that we're seeing on EU. And if you look at it on country basis, which I'm sure you have, it's, you know, you've got some countries that have gone up significantly and some that have dipped. And then if you look at it over a longer timeline, back to 2016, it's fairly stable and consistent. So I think and obviously it's reasonably uncertain in the medium term as well, depending on how this year pans out. So I think the bigger sort of impacts are going to be on the non-EU. It'll be really interesting to see where we end up at the end of cycle, because we know, for example, those that have been that third increase on China, we know that very often they are applying to other countries around the world. So actually, how many of them actually end up studying in the UK? Maybe much less. I also think there's an interesting piece internationally, and this includes the EU, around where students come from, and how they're applying, and what choice they're making, and when they're making them. And all of that, I think, is one to watch during the course of this year. So we're publishing a piece on the 20th of February, which is just on that international community and how they're making decisions. Because as that becomes a more important part of every university's portfolio, understanding that international cohort is paramount. And some universities understand it to a greater extent than others.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Hilary Jebiabuzio, and I'm the Undergraduate Education Officer at Bristol SU, and I've actually written my first article for Wonky all about the use of the term sector leading in higher education. And essentially, I explore a main premise which looks at whether our institutions are looking to be sector leading, which infers and implies an individualised view of themselves, where recognition, reputation and meeting requirements of the OSS at the centre of the change that they do and the work that they do, or if we're looking at institutions being sector achieving, where they're looking to create fundamental change that's right and necessary for their institutions, especially in areas like EDI, where some of our most vulnerable groups are suffering because fundamental change is not being made at the rate that it needs to be made.
So, the politics of offer making has heated up in recent years. Unconditional offers particularly have been all over the headlines. Alison, has any of this changed applicant behaviour from your perspective?
I think certainly from a University of Liverpool perspective, not really. I mean, in terms of offer making, we believe very firmly in transparency. And, you know, we don't engage, for example, in conditional, unconditional offer making, which I know many of universities have done. I think what is possibly, I think, interesting in what's happening at the moment is as we see these kind of tactics continue to rise, but students less likely to accept those, is I think that the conversion piece is becoming more important for universities because we are certainly across the sector less able to rely on the number of applications and being able to predict the number of students coming through because they're holding such a variety of offers and in different ways.
I mean, Dan, you work with lots of different universities. Are you seeing a change in strategy over particularly over offer making this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there feels like there is. It'd be interesting to, we've got obviously nothing in the data at this stage on that. You know, I've been fascinated by the defence of CUCs in terms of their impact on attainment. I'm not sure that's the point really. In terms of the way I look at it, it might be too early to pronounce on that. You know, the real issue, I think, is that that can't be the way you want an under pressure 18-year-old to choose the place they're going to study for 3 years. That feels a bit wrong. So I think that's how I see that issue. You know, we saw, I mean, in terms of habits, in terms of application, we saw, you know, quite dramatic improvements in the week before the window closed, even more so than normal. I don't know whether that was simply down to it being Wednesday, January the 15th, and having 3 working days running up to that, Claire. I don't know whether there's any basis in that, but it was a big shift for some institutions.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we were exceptionally busy the 3 days leading up and quieter that weekend before, just because of where 15th of January fell this year. I mean, I think, you know, Alison is right. Student views to both unconditionals and conditional unconditionals are varied and changing. And so, you know, when we ask students about unconditionals in the round, some of those students do like them. They find it takes the pressure off. They find they can focus on their studies. Others feel that, you know, a provider or university might not have considered their application fully enough. And so there's very, very views. But I think, you know, importantly, that when we looked at those conditional unconditionals and the number of students that were taking those up as firm, seeing that big 5% drop last week was, I mean, it's not a trend, it's only 1 year, but it was a signal that perhaps student views and even parental guardian views on those types of offers were changing. I mean, I think in a market, and HE is a market, you are going to get, you know, whether you call them conversion tactics or whether you call them, you know, just ways to get your institution ahead of another one, you are going to get tactics. And my cautionary note is, even if conditional unconditionals end up falling, either in the offer or the acceptance of those, there will be other things that go on. So whether that's, you know, a very low grade offer or something like that. So, you know, in any market, you'll see different emerging tactics. So that's one to watch.
Mm. And Claire, what about the political pressure, though, on the sector over this issue? Do you think the tide is turning? I mean, we've been talking about this for months now on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is, I mean, obviously, the Office of Students have come out and made statements on this, as well as ministers. I think, you know, our first indications, as we said last week, are that the tide might be turning, particularly on conditional unconditionals. But again, that's a cautionary sort of note about that, because it might be turning and other tactics might be being deployed. And the key thing is, some of those tactics might be in students' interest, but where they are not in the interest of transparency and fairness and allowing students to make a really considered choice for what, for many of them, as we all know, is probably the biggest decision of their lives so far. I think that's where we need to be careful and watch what happens. So just because one sort of tactic might be on the decline, another one might emerge in its place.
The in terms of that sort of fairness and aspiration, one thing that I think we should all be paying a bit of attention to is the difference in tariff requirements dependent on the time in the cycle that someone applies. You know, it's going to limit aspiration if you need more tariff points to secure a place at a university during the UCAS application window than you do to get a place at that same institution on exam results day. So that means that applicants might not dare to apply to University X in September but they might well have been able to get into University X the following August. So, you know, there's complicating factors here around the reputation of universities, around published tariffs. But, you know, when I'm looking at challenges around regional participation rates, I do think it's a big issue. So is there a discussion that we should be having around whether universities should be ranked so heavily on the basis of what they take in, and should there be more focus on the progression of students and what and the student that graduates from that institution? I just I think it's not a level playing field at the moment.
I mean I'm a great believer in transparency, and as you know, I sort of see UCAS's role as creating as transparent and open a sort of system as possible in terms of the access to data that we have. I do think there's something that Dan raised at the beginning there, which is about what are the actual entry grades that students have got in perhaps over the last, you know, 2-3 years, rather than necessarily what a course is advertised as the tariff to get into. And I think that would be a massive step forward for universities in terms of being very transparent with students about what the offer is, which obviously would be it might be a blended, you know, course average based on both direct clearing and in terms of the main scheme. But I think there's a step forward we could all do as a sector in terms of transparency around actually what it takes to get onto a course. But I take down the second point as well, about, you know, ultimately what you graduate with is of most importance. I would say I still put my A levels on my CV even at nearly 58 years of age. So I do think there's something about you know, a bit of balance there.
This debate over kind of input measures and NEET tables has been running for years. It seems to me though, kind of largely in the gift of universities to ignore the ones if you think that it's skewed by basically, you know, what the tariff points are going in. Then you should focus on promoting yourself in the league tables that just ignore that and do focus on outcomes. I wonder if any of you got any sense of whether prospective students and applicants and parents are increasingly savvy to that, or whether, you know, those, you know, very prestigious tables that, as I say, include tariff points still hold a lot of sway.
I think from my perspective, I think they absolutely do. I think, you know, they're quite often an initial reference point for students to begin their selection in terms of universities that they wish to visit in the first round of open days. So I do think they are still important. I think the Dan's point around, you know, outcomes, I think would be welcomed by a many number of universities, because, you know, looking purely at tariff points doesn't truly give you the whole picture of what a university is about in many respects. So I think that would be really worthwhile looking at for league table providers.
I think Alison's absolutely right. I think parents particularly still look at league tables, and it's a big driver. I do think if we're thinking about widening participation, what we hear more and more from students is actually, tell me about the experience of a like student at that university studying that course. And that's both most disadvantaged students, but also international students who perhaps can't attend an open day or you know, have no idea what it's going to be like to, you know, study in the north of England or London or whatever. So I think initiatives like, you know, our partnership with Unibuddy, where you can get to message somebody who's done that course at that university or is doing it right now, really, really important. And we're seeing much more of a students valuing that over necessary league tables. They still play an important role, and particularly for parents and guardians, but I think students themselves want to hear from people like them at that place studying what they are looking to study.
And some of the work we're doing around conversion has shifted actually a lot in the last cycle and a half or so, and it's the messages that institutions are wanting to send out now are quite personalized, but they're really focusing now on, you know, will I fit in, answering that question to individuals who might be really quite concerned about whether they will be in the right place when they get there. And sometimes universities have been guilty of converting with messages they want to say to somebody and not thinking about it from the lens of what that young person is worried about at the moment. And will I fit in is a big, you know, factor for people, I would suggest.
Hello, it's Jim from the team. The Secret Life of Students 2020. It's our student experience conference where we'll be doing student experience differently. 19th of March, London, Mermaid Centre. You've got to be there. It's all about doing the student experience differently. We're going to bring together research and intel and review everything we learned about students in 2019 and ask what that means for government and regulators and universities and their students' unions. It's about getting beyond the stale debates and case studies and rethinking the student experience, bringing together experts and sector leaders and managers, as well as student leaders and student junior managers, to forge a new agenda for students. What does that mean? Well, we'll look at what the new government and the associated regulatory agenda mean for students. We'll take a look at what major changes to funding, the TEF and the National Student Survey could mean for universities and their student unions. If Generation Z is a generation that treasures fairness, we'll think about how we can respond to strengthen students' rights, how teaching and learning could be changing to adapt to 2020's busy students, and we'll have a think about what student influence and partnership mean in a world of big data. We'll also ask how we might get beyond the reductive, endless circular debates on free speech and build a culture of democratic engagement on campus. We'll find out what happens when you listen to students on their own terms, and we'll explore what safety means to students and what safeguarding really means. It's going to be great, an essential event for anyone working on policy and delivery for students. To find out more, you want wonky.com/events, where you'll find details of speakers. The agenda will emerge in the next couple of weeks, and details of how to get your ticket.
So, we've seen a small uptick in applications this year, but we're still in a demographic dip. Dan, tell us how universities are marketing in a shrinking market.
Well, it's been a challenging few cycles. There's obviously a huge amount of pressure on institutions to recruit due to their own number forecasts, financial pressures, fierce competition. And you see it particularly in areas like around London, the Southwest, Wales. There's also big challenges we've been talking about around application rates in the Northeast and areas like that. A key objective, I guess, for us and at the institutions we work with, has been to generate the right applications, not the most applications. You know, universities need to identify and engage with applicants that are right for them and then communicate their institution's own characteristics. And where I am seeing universities having success is in using their own detailed cohort data, combining it with wider market data, and then building a clear picture of what are realistic opportunities to recruit. So institutions who identify and establish priority segments can then achieve what I, you know, sometimes think of as the holy grail of maintaining and or growing student numbers, even if their application numbers are under pressure or shrinking. And one of the things I observe and really try and counter is that the answer to this question cannot always be London for everyone. Campaign to recruit students from London. I see too many conversations with people saying, well, we've got to be, you know, building our brand in London. And these institutions are sometimes trying to grow, you know, market shares that from very small to much higher. And that's very expensive to do in London. So I think that it's really important that people look at other areas of the country at where there are students like students that are successful in their institution. And they, you know, build the right tactics and communication campaigns to talk to those students and engage with those students.
I've often wondered about the London question as a Londoner myself, walking on the transport network, particularly on the tube. You see adverts for universities that are, you know, very far away, and potentially, you know, you sometimes see a, you know, perhaps you're on a Circle Line that goes to Paddington. So, you know, there's an advert for something in the Southwest, but things that are much harder to understand. And I always wonder what the impact of those ads are, because they do look really expensive.
Yeah, they are. And the impact is, you know, it varies, I guess, depending on what the university knows about that potential audience. You know, unis have got stacks of data on the factors that, you know, contribute to someone enrolling at their institution. So they need to use that to engage with the right groups of applicants, ones that might thrive at their institution, and not potentially wasting money and time generating, you know, vanity applications, you know, that from individuals who are never realistically going to come to that institution. Now, this shouldn't limit growth, you know, because you can find students like your students in other new markets around the UK, but it you know, it has to be sensible to take an approach that doesn't waste money on those types of situations, as you described, Mark.
I would absolutely agree with Dan in terms of the channels as well. So it's not just about, I think targeting is one thing. So understanding, rather than broad brush sort of fire hose pipe sort of out there, you've got to target. So you've got to understand your cohorts that are successful. But what channels you're using. And I would argue for most institutions, billboards, whether they've been London or elsewhere, are less effective than things like, you know, social media marketing, which is very, when you really target there. So I think there's something about targeting, but also the channels you're using to get that cohort. I think also what we find from students more and more is telling stories. So going back to that, you know, here is a student. And so, you know, part of our upgrade of all of our content and all our different channels is tell it through a story. You know, students do not want reams and reams of text-based. They want an individual telling a story about how they were successful, what the experience was like at that institution. I also think it's hooking in, as Dan said, to individual institutions and what drives choices in terms of particularly conversion for individual institutions. So, for example, we know modules in course, pretty much whether, you know, you're an international student or a UK student, is a very, very big driver in terms of choices. But equally, there are other things for individual institutions which might be further up that sort of choice priority list than you might think. So things like accommodation. And the access to the quality, the you know, the price of accommodation, things like the place, the social activities, which, I mean, all of those things will appear in the top 10, but where they appear in that top 10 for that institution will be very different depending on who they are. So, yeah, I tell it by stories, but also really understand students at your university, why they make the choice to come there.
I think authenticity in marketing, you see much more of that now. You see much more of the student content, you know, students telling the stories rather than people like myself trying to put ourselves in the shoes of prospective students, and the rise of social media channels as a means of attraction, not just both paid social channels, but also your organic content is very much around showcasing what it's really like for students and giving them all the information available so they can make that right choice about whether they fit within a university that they're interested in. I think that's increasingly important and a big focus for marketing teams.
And Asim, do you use the data in the same way that Dan describes?
In terms of segmentation and targeting? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you know, the fact that within my area we have a market insight and data science team, I think highlights the importance of understanding the data, understanding your own students, understanding your applicants, and this distinctive characteristics that people attracted to you have. So it does mean that you can spend your budget much more wisely in areas where that you know it's most likely to have an impact. I completely agree about, you know, none of us have reams of money to splash on billboards in areas where, you know, we're just doing huge awareness campaigns to anybody without it being targeted. We have to really understand our students and who we're targeting so that we can, you know, make the very best use of the budgets we have available.
It's interesting. The flip side of that is that, you know, technology enabled us to reach loads of people pretty easily. So it created the potential to bombard big audiences with communication, and that challenge around over communication, I think, is a serious one for the sector, because that, you know, if you're communicating with lots of people and only some of those are actually relevant for your institution, then that's confusing for applicants or potential applicants. That's another reason why it's better to concentrate on realistic and you know, ambitious target audiences and personalize that engagement rather than sit there with a credit card on social media and spend inordinate amounts of money serving ads to anyone and everyone. I think, you know, that personalized applicant journey and student experience as much as possible is crucial, and in turn will have an impact on retention, you know, because that's the other big waste of money for everyone is if you spend all this time, you know, trying to get someone through the door and they're the wrong person or they're not supported and they end up, you know, not finishing that first year, you know, that's really difficult for all concerned. You know, most importantly, the student.
Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question is Wonky's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Harder to get into than a number 10 lobby briefing, and much more enjoyable when you do. It's the much-demanded return of Yes, But Does It Correlate? Biological science and subject allied to medicines are two closely aligned subject groups. But, in 2018-19, does strengths in one necessarily mean strengths in the other? I've plotted the raw numbers of students at all levels at each institution. Yes, but does it correlate?
Okay, well, I'm going to think no, it doesn't. different people. They don't necessarily the same people interested in both areas. And I'm wondering whether nursing messes this up in terms of that correlation. But, you know, that's my guess.
Yeah, I probably, it's a difficult one, I'd probably agree with Dan on the face of it, because I think it's probably skewed, as he says. But I wouldn't bet my house on it.
Well, I'm tempted to change my mind now, but I actually think, yes, perhaps it does. But, you know, I wouldn't bet my house on it either.
And the answer is no, not really. R squared is 0.25, suggesting a very weak relationship, more likely to be explained by provider size and the similarity between two subject areas. The numbers are taken from the recent release of HESA student open data, thanks HESA, and where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
So from next year, we're going to start to see the demographics move up again and huge amounts more of 18-year-olds coming into the system over the next decade. It's something we've been writing about quite a bit on the site for the last couple of years. And posing a question over and over again is the sector ready? Are universities ready for that growth? And what should universities be doing now to prepare for that decade ahead?
Yeah, certainly. I think, first of all, although we are seeing that uplift, it is different. I think we do need to remember this in different parts of the country. So, for example, when you look at the demographics in the northeast and the northwest of England, they probably take another year before they start on that uptick, whereas London's still very significant increase next year. So I think understanding some of that demographic landscape in a bit more detail for individual institutions is quite important. And then in terms of your preparatory point, one of the big things when I visit universities, and I'm probably near 100 now that I've gone through in the last couple of years, is a big focus on developing their physical estate, both the teaching facilities and the accommodation. And actually, I think there's a need, and some that you can see some of the universities really grappling with this at the moment in terms of their digital estate, and understanding how they can use their digital estate, not just for the student experience, but in terms of moving some of the ways they teach and the access to campus very differently in 5-10 years' time. And if you think about potentially many more people coming through their door, then I think they have to do that. And you will know many universities have space constraints as well, so there's a pressure on them to do that. But I also think students expect that. Students expect in this day and age there to be a blended learning of face-to-face, but also access to things in a very digital, easy-to-access way. So I think for me, the one thing would be the universities that are getting it right are putting digital estate alongside physical estate.
Do you think there's a challenge in the UK more than in other markets around the reputation in terms of online learning qualifications and online learning degrees? I wonder, we work with employers as well as universities. I wonder whether we've still got a way to go in terms of the value they place on online degrees as much as traditional ones. And if we look ahead 10 years and we've got, you know, many more young people, the choice is not between the different types of education that we need to provide. It is, we need to provide all of them, more of all of them. Otherwise, we will be in a bit of a fix. So I don't know whether there's a job to do in terms of a reputational shift or continued one around online learning.
But also making sure it's blended, because I don't think it's an either or. You know, when you expect to study, you expect to, you know, have an element of online, an element of face-to-face. You know, I think all of it's trying to pull off what is a very blended sort of channels of learning, I think is where we need to be. But, you know, and again, I agree with you in that, have we cracked that? Can we hold up really good cases where we've cracked that blended learning and are telling stories? So we go back to the point we made earlier about telling stories to students where they've been successful in a blended learning environment, and lots of universities do blended learning now, but it's perhaps shifting that balance towards more digital online, I think, is where we need more storytelling.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, and I think over the next decade, I think universities looking at their position and their offering in relation to blended, and what that means for everything else, for the study abroad opportunities, for the careers, advice and guidance, and the rest of the kind of experience they get from a university and where that fits in. And I could imagine the model would change quite significantly, where you could do more of the actual learning online. You could be engaging with your tutors perhaps in a more meaningful way face to face, but still using the university environment to get that much broader experience. I can imagine the landscape changing quite significantly.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Claire, Dan, Alison and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen. And until next week, stay wonky.